what we're talking about is a massive industrialization in an area that's very important to a large number of species.
A big oil discovery on the North Slope in a location of concern to conservationists. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new archbishop for Alaska.
I did not say yes immediately, but asked for a day to digest and discern what my best response might be.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. More than 25,000 Alaskans are part of the Salmon Project family. Through stories, news, and a whole lot of salmon love, they're building a statewide community united by salmon. Find them on Facebook and join the conversation. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Kalis Energy says it's made a major oil discovery on the North Slope at Smith Bay. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The company estimates the oil under its current state leases at 6 billion barrels and says as much as 10 billion may lie under the shallow bay.
It's going to be a massive development, very important for the state of Alaska, and it's going to create, you know, thousands of jobs.
That's Jim Musselman. He's the CEO of Kalis. He says two wells drilled this year, sidewall cores and 3D seismic work, suggest a large reservoir of light oil in good rock.
And we have the same fan complexes under each well, so that gives us courage that the fan extends over this big area.
Production is years away. Kalis says the development could eventually boost the amount of oil going down the Trans-Alaska pipeline by about 200,000 barrels per day, an increase of nearly 40% over current daily averages. And Musselman says the light oil will help cut sludge, improving the pipeline's flow. The CEO estimates the cost of the project at $8 to $10 billion. He says he's confident he can get financing if the price of oil goes up to $65 a barrel. He says state tax credits are also crucial.
We can, in fact, help with their fiscal crisis going forward if they'll help us. And I think that's all we're looking for.
In June, Governor Bill Walker vetoed oil tax credits worth $430 million, saying the state couldn't afford to pay so much to oil companies. However, the state is still obligated to pay them at some point in the future. Smith Bay is 150 miles west of Prudhoe Bay. The Kalis leases are in state waters off the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Lois Epstein, Arctic Director for the Wilderness Society, says there's a lot to worry about with this project. Smith Bay is next to the Teshupuk Lake area, a large freshwater wetland that Epstein says is important to waterfowl, caribou, and polar bear, and for subsistence.
Essentially, what we're talking about is a massive industrialization in an area that's very, very important to a large number of species.
The company plans to begin environmental studies now and drill an appraisal well during the winter that begins in 2017. Reporting for Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Pope Francis and the Catholic Church have named Alaska's next archbishop. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, he was introduced to the community today at the Archdiocese of Anchorage.
So I'd like to introduce Archbishop-elect Paul Aitchen.
The introduction was made by outgoing Archbishop Roger Schweitz, who had been at the head of the Archdiocese of Anchorage since 2001.
This is a very, very special day for me personally, since it's been 15 months since I sent in my resignation to our Holy Father, and he finally responded. I thought maybe he lost the letter.
Schweitz submitted his resignation last year when he turned 75 years old, as required by the church. Upon receiving the news that he was selected to lead the Archdiocese of Anchorage, Archbishop-elect Paul Ashen, who is 57, says it took him by surprise.
Truthfully, I did not say yes immediately, but asked for a day to digest and discern what my best response might be to this unexpected turn in my life in the church.
Ashen has spent the last 8 years serving as the Bishop of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the appointment and prospective move to Alaska would take him even further from his family in Indiana. But Ashen says after a night of contemplation and prayer, he found his answer.
I've been a priest 24 and a half years now, and I promised the Lord in those ordination promises that I would follow wherever he led. So I'm here because I followed the Lord here.
Despite the initial apprehension, Ashen says he is looking forward to getting to know the land and the people that make up his new home. And Ashen says he is a longtime supporter of the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People, which was established in the wake of allegations of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic clergy, which included several Alaska communities.
I'm very committed to doing everything that not only we are required to do, but what we as a church desire to do, to create a safe environment for our young people and our vulnerable adults, and to do everything necessary when and if there are abuses, to take the appropriate steps to make sure that we respond accordingly.
Ashen says he was the first priest from the Archdiocese of Indianapolis to serve on the Committee for the Protection of Children and Young People, and he's currently serving his second term on the Bishop's Committee. The Archdiocese of Anchorage serves more than 11,000 families and maintains parishes and missions from Anchorage and Eagle River to Valdez and Cordova to Dillingham and Dutch Harbor and many in between. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Alaska Department of Transportation is cutting back again on maintenance due to state funding reductions. DOT Northern Region spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the department is ceasing maintenance at the Circle Airport and closing five road maintenance stations on the Steese Highway at Central, on the Edgerton at Chitna, along the Richardson Highway at Birch Lake, and on the Taylor Highway at O'Brien Creek.
We've been talking about this for, kind of since last December when we knew that we were going to be facing some pretty significant budget cuts, and we went and talked to these communities. All of them are really upset about this. It definitely impacts these communities.
Bailey says the maintenance will be picked up by staff and vehicles operating out of other DOT stations within 100 miles.
While all roads are going to remain open, it'll take us longer to plow snow and ice, especially after a heavy storm or an ice event.
Bailey says the cutbacks, which also include reducing the Richardson Highway maintenance station at Thompson Pass outside Valdez to winter only, reflect a $60 million reduction in DOT general fund dollars for statewide maintenance over the last 2 years.
We've already, for the past 2 years, been reducing our number of staff. So we have laid people off. We've been letting go of equipment, cutting back on our overtime hours. So we've been doing all of that for as long as we could without impacting the actual maintenance stations. So really, this closing the maintenance stations was kind of the last thing we wanted to do.
Bailey says if the budget-cutting trend continues, more maintenance stations will be closed. Arguments have been scheduled for next month in a lawsuit challenging Governor Bill Walker's cut to this year's Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. State Court Judge William Morris generally agreed to a sped-up schedule requested by the parties, but he said a proposed decision date of December 2nd might not be achievable. He said he won't know for sure until motions have been filed. Arguments are set for November 17th in Anchorage. Governor Bill Walker yesterday requested the expedited review. In a press release, Walker said, quote, "Alaskans deserve a definitive answer as we gear up for a legislative session in which bold action is required to finally fix our fiscal deficit." The lawsuit was filed September 16th by Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski and two retired lawmakers, Clem Tillian and Rick Halford. It says the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation was obligated by law to make available nearly $1.4 billion from the fund's earnings reserve for dividends, in spite of a Walker veto reducing that amount. The resulting dividend will be about half of what it otherwise would have been. Walker has defended his veto as necessary as Alaska grapples with a budget deficit. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a mother's memoir of her children's abduction by her ex-husband.
And so we'd stop visiting, or we'd start driving around the house, break into the house, look in the windows.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A proposed coal mine near the village of Tyonek could move a step closer, depending on a draft environmental impact statement expected to be released this month by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But as Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, changes in a state application for the Chuitna mine could delay an already lengthy process.
Although PacRim's plan to mine coal near the Chuitna River on the west side of Cook Inlet has been in the works for years, an expected draft environmental impact study on the project is now behind schedule. Jason Berkner, a manager with the Special Actions Branch of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Regulatory Division, says the EIS is on hold for the time being.
Essentially, the project went into a hiatus mode.
The Corps is waiting for portions of a state review process to catch up, so this is what is putting them behind schedule, according to Russell Kirkham, who manages Alaska's coal regulatory program. Kirkham said in an email that the Department of Natural Resources has completed another round of reviews of PacRim's application in late August. PacRim is currently working to address the state's comments, Kirkham says, and he does not have an estimate on when they will be complete. The Corps' Berkner says if PacRim doesn't provide the requested information by October 21st, the EIS application is withdrawn.
If we have, you know, 90 days of inactivity in this particular case, we would administratively withdraw the application. And it's important to know that to note that that is an administrative process. The applicant could, you know, start working on the project again at any time once they provide the information that we require.
Environmental activists opposed to the Chuitna mine are also waiting for the draft EIS to be released. Carly Weir, a program manager with Cook Inlet Keeper, says she's in the dark as to the delay.
This has been such a long process. At the beginning of this year, we assumed that we would see finally the draft application and documents, and the public would have a chance to review this project. Unfortunately, now it's October, and we're looking at another delay and another year in uncertain future for this project and really the fate of the Chuitna watershed.
Weir says her organization is against the mine because PacRim's plan would mine through a salmon-bearing tributary of the Chuitna. There is contention as to whether the salmon habitat can be restored after mining stops. The Corps' Berkner.
That is precisely one of the questions that we're trying to get at through this EIS process.
Weir says not having an EIS will stall the mine project for a while, but it is still a concern.
We'd like to see the project books closed permanently. The reason we're looking at this project again for 10 years since 2007, when the most recent rendition of the Chuitna coal mine project has come up, is because the environmental impact statement and project that was theoretically approved in the 90s was shelved due to low coal markets.
The price of coal has tumbled during the past couple of years, but Dan Graham, a project manager with PacRim, said in an email that PacRim is not focused on today's prices. He says coal forecasts are strong to 2030 and beyond, and that, quote, an investment like this looks to the long term. Graham says PacRim is in the process of responding to the state's review, and that should be done by this week. He says a 60-day state public comment period will coincide with a public comment period on the Corps' EIS. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Governor Bill Walker announced today that Alaska will be receiving just over $1 million in grant funding from the U.S. Department of Justice to process over 1,000 sexual assault evidence kits currently in possession of Alaska state troopers. The three-year grant will allow for the kits to be analyzed at a state crime lab, as well as paying for cold case investigators and prosecuting attorneys to carry out cases that emerge from the findings. The grant follows an inventory review that determined there are more than 3,000 unprocessed kits across the state in possession of law enforcement. Alaska consistently ranks high in sexual assaults in the United States, with reports at about 2.5 times the national average, a ranking that the governor described as an epidemic. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is testing patients for hepatitis B, C, and HIV after partially sterilized dental instruments were used on patients. Up to 13 people may have made contact with the instruments out of the 191 patients seen during the 9-day period in question. When YKHC discovered the error, they consulted with the Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the CDC. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur talked to some of the same people.
Here are two of the people YKHC talked to.
My name is Louisa Castrodale, and I'm one of the epidemiologists with the State Section of Epidemiology Division of Public Health.
This is Joseph Purs. I am a healthcare epidemiologist with CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion.
When asked about the risk of infection, both said the same thing.
This is a situation where the chances are rather low and maybe even theoretical that there would have been an exposure.
This is something that, in our risk assessment poses a very, very low theoretical risk of infection.
Theoretical risk. Here's what that means. It's theoretical because it's not known if any of the instruments were even contaminated with hepatitis B, C, or HIV. First, the instruments would have had to have been used on a person who carried one of those viruses. Second, the instruments would have had to have retained some blood. Third, the virus would have had to survive the first two steps of the three-step cleaning process, detergent and ultrasound. YKHC just missed the last step, heat. Susan Jones is the HIV STD program manager for the Alaska Section of Epidemiology. She didn't talk to YKHC, but she thinks the cleaning that did happen was enough to kill HIV, which was highly unlikely to be on the instruments anyway.
We have very few new infections a year and very few folks that have infection that live in Alaska.
So few that last year there were only 64 cases of HIV reported in the state. None were in southwest Alaska. With hepatitis C, 91 cases were reported in southwest Alaska last year, and no cases of hepatitis B were reported. There's no vaccination for HIV or hepatitis C, but most people get vaccinated against hepatitis B as infants. In fact, a national immunization survey showed between 2000 and 2001, 90% of Alaska Native infants were vaccinated against hepatitis B. So few people in the region even have these illnesses to pass on. And CDC's Dr. Purs says the viruses don't do well outside the body.
So hepatitis B is an example where experimental studies have shown that the virus remains viable for weeks, potentially, in the environment. Hepatitis C is more medium level in that regard, and so its viability would be measured in hours or days. And HIV is thought to be the least hardy of those three, so it may only survive a very short while on an inanimate surface.
A CDC study showed that just drying HIV caused a 90 to 99% reduction in concentration within several hours.
I would say, again, in this situation, patients can be reassured that there was actually very little risk.
But it's not zero.
Again, Louisa Castrodale, Alaska epidemiologist.
And so the decision was made to continue to reach out to those patients.
YKHC wasn't required to contact patients and tell them what happened or offer free blood tests. CDC's Dr. Purs calls their situation a gray zone, but one where transparency is encouraged and one where it was chosen. to anyone who got one of those calls, he offers this way to look at it.
13 patients might have been exposed to these instruments. There are actually 191 patients who are sort of in the risk pool. That translates as 178 patients who, you know, actually would have zero risk at all. And I would say for the remaining 13 patients, the risk is, you know, so low as to be close to negligible.
So the takeaway is few people in the area have the viruses to pass on. The viruses probably couldn't survive the initial cleaning process, but a risk still exists. So as HIV STD program manager Susan Jones said,
to get tested.
Get tested. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
October 4th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open at 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring someone to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
One of the numerous cost-saving realignments within the University of Alaska system, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism and Communications Departments, have merged. Professor Charles Mason says the merger should save money and shore up the journalism department, which has seen a declining number of majors in recent years.
The point of this merger is to have probably a smaller core faculty over the long run, but to increase our number of majors in the two programs together so that it's a single department with a reasonable number of majors and a pretty large number of students. And the savings will come in through that.
Mason says the combined journalism communications program has more than 60 majors and a dozen graduate students. He says the merger, which includes plans for co-location at a single facility, has resulted in the elimination of an administrative job. Child abduction is a nightmare not many parents have had to deal with, but Anchorage author Lisbeth Meredith knows firsthand how terrifying it is. In 1994, her former husband kidnapped their two young daughters and took them to Greece. It took 2 years to get them back. Meredith has written a memoir of that time called Pieces of Me. She says she tried to make her marriage work for herself and her girls, but it just got worse.
It had been a miserable, miserable union, but I thought, I can do this. I can stay in this marriage. It escalated in 1990 to the point of violence that he strangled me, and the girls were there. One daughter was upstairs, the other one was watching, and there were very little. And I think something snapped in that moment. I'd had a friend who said, you alone will know when it's time to leave, if it ever becomes time to leave. Only you will know this. And that was that moment where I thought, they cannot be raised like this. I don't deserve this. They certainly don't deserve this. And I don't want them growing up thinking this is normal.
When you left, what kind of a court battle did you have about custody and visiting?
It was ugly. It was as ugly. It was an extension of the control. I had made this bold move, in a sense, to get away from this kind of life and this abusive relationship. And so I was fortunate to have the assistance of a legal aid, Alaska Legal Services. And my husband had hired an attorney, and it was just very, very, very contentious. In the end, I got joint legal custody and sole physical custody. The girls were pretty tiny. Sometimes my former husband would visit during the days that he'd asked for, and that was, quite honestly, I needed a break. So sometimes he would take the girls for visitation very regularly. I thought, well, you know, this could get better over time, and then it would just change. And so he'd stop visiting, or he'd start driving around the house, break into the house, look in the windows. One or two times I got protective orders, and it was just tense.
What kind of support did you have around you? How isolated did you feel in this?
By then, I had been on food stamps, had finished my degree. I had a couple years of college before I got married. and then got a job at Awake and abused women's aid in crisis. And that was just a fabulous time for me because by then I'd made some friends back. I wasn't isolated anymore. I had a roommate who was grandmotherly age for the girls, and she just, and to this day, still loves them. What I didn't realize then was the more strong I felt, the more independent, the more I accomplished, the more at risk I would be. Even though I was no longer with my former husband, that for him was absolutely unacceptable. So when I graduated college, when I got the job, all of those things seemed to really enrage him.
He was still threatened somehow.
Yes. He was still threatened, and he one time did tell me, I do these things because I think if I make you miserable enough, you'll come back.
1994 arrives. You've had this sort of back and forth, tense relationship. And then one day he leaves with him. How did you first find out that he had actually left?
I went to pick the children up at the daycare. We just finished renegotiating that he wouldn't come to my home to drop off the girls, that we would have to do it at the daycare. I showed up to pick the girls up on a snowy day after work, and they weren't there. And staff had not heard from him, which was kind of unusual. I thought, well, okay, we'll just go figure this out. And so I went back home, tried to make some phone calls, and then it just became abundantly clear, no, this is not normal. So I went ahead and eventually called police. And I think the officer first basically said, ma'am, he's the dad. Why do you got to be so hard on him? Can't you just let him have extra time? Why does this have to be such a high-toned thing? Because he didn't know. And so when I explained it to him more clearly, he was like, okay, I understand. So I'm going to do some digging around. And then within a couple hours, he heard a confirmation that 2 days before, the day that my kids went to be with their dad for a visitation, that he had taken them and left the country.
I can't imagine what you were feeling when you realized that he had not only abducted your daughters, but had left the entire United States. What was that moment like?
It was terrifying, and yet almost immediately after, I realized the worst thing has happened. And if I can resolve this, if I can get the girls back, we are done. I can bring them home, and this will be the end of all of these years of chaos.
Lisbeth Meredith's new memoir is called Pieces of Me, Rescuing My Kidnapped Daughters. Her book launch is tomorrow at UAA's bookstore at 5 p.m. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Josh Edge and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.